This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With Governor Wilder out of the race, there's no black candidate running in the presidential primaries. You might think that the candidates would be courting black voters. But a new report from the Urban League says that the candidates are virtually ignoring the civil rights and economic concerns of African Americans. My guest Ron Walters is the author of a book on black presidential politics in America. Walters is a professor at Howard University. He's also advised members of the Congressional Black Caucus and was deputy campaign manager for Jesse Jackson. He's a former board member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Walters estimates that there are 10 million black voters in the country, largely centered in the Democratic Party. He says the black vote was critical in the election of Jimmy Carter, but these days the black vote seems to wield less influence in the Democratic Party.
There's been a tendency on the part of the Democratic Party to want to hold the black vote at some arm's length, based on the proposition that the American electorate has increasingly identified the Democratic Party as the party of minorities, meaning substantially the party of blacks. And that has been a critical factor in the decision of many people to switch and vote Republican. So Democrats, Democratic leaders, Democratic Party nominees are sensitive to that. And there's been a trend toward not campaigning as vigorously in the black community. Of course, blacks have responded to that with the higher levels of alienation. Blacks, of course, one of those groups who are refusing to call themselves increasingly strong Democrats in the surveys of voter identification.
Well, why are Democrats starting to see the black vote as a liability?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the strength of the conservative movement. I think when you see the shift in voter identification from Democrat to Republican, especially in the South, but really all over the country, the drama of course, the Reagan administration and the awe with his landslides, the national tide and the strength of the conservative movement, when you see that and the fact that the Democrats have been out of power for so long, it has built a kind of respect for the conservative temper of the American electorate on the part of Democratic leadership. And so I think that basically what you had was the beginning in the early 1970s. Black people had just come out of a civil rights movement. Now, whites responded to that movement in some positive ways, but there was also a negative backlash. And I think really that negative backlash began to set up the seeds of a counter-reaction to the civil rights movement. And when you combine that with the tough economic times of the early 1970s, I think you had all of the ingredients of a full-scale revolt against racial preferences and progress in America. And that culminated, I think, in the far more conservative age that we have today.
Thomas Etzel, in his new book, Chain Reaction, which is about race and politics, says that 1964, the election immediately following the passage of the Civil Rights Act, an election won by Lyndon Johnson, was the last presidential election in which racial liberalism was seen as politically advantageous. Do you agree with that?
Well, of course, I don't necessarily agree with that. I think racial liberalism was advantageous in the election of 1968. I think if he's talking about the Democratic Party, I think that racial liberalism was functional through the election of Jimmy Carter. And I think it's only been recently, when you look at the crop of Democratic candidates running for president in the election of 1988, I think there you begin to get a very serious difference. No longer was it very fashionable to say that you were a liberal. And the L word, of course, was really not the thing to be identified with. So when you look at this crop of candidates today, in perspective to those in 1988, you have a continuation of a trend where people are not only refusing to identify themselves as liberal, but also gravitating far more closely to a conservative, Republican-oriented type of public policy philosophy than ever before, to the point where I would argue today there's very little distinction between some of the people who are running for president on the Democratic side and some of the policies that have been pursued by Republicans, both in the White House and in the Congress.
Do you think that black voters are seen by many white politicians as being a special interest group and that many white politicians would be afraid of being seen as, quote, beholden to blacks?
I think that the whole definition of a Democratic Party, the characterization of a Democratic Party, which emerged as a party that favored special interest groups, that particular characterization had a lot to do with defining the Democratic Party as the party of blacks. It also meant labor, women's groups, and so forth. And when you look at these movements, blacks, women, and labor, all of these were political movements of recent times that have one way or another alienated a very important group, white males, white liberals, white middle-class males. And that was the group that has been far more loyal to the conservative movement and was the base of Ronald Reagan's support. So, yes, it is true that even though any major political party is comprised of special interest, and certainly the Republican Party is, that when you talk about special interest, it is and has in many quarters become a code word for the black part of the Democratic Party's constituency.
We've seen many more black conservatives in the media lately, you know, writing op-ed pieces. Clarence Thomas was a good example of a black conservative coming to prominence, and a lot of the people who supported him became more public during the hearings, and we got to see a lot of them. Do you think that there is a larger black conservative vote now, and do you think the black vote is becoming less monolithic than it ever was?
Well, I don't think necessarily the black conservatives have much of a constituency in the black community. And the reason for that, of course, is that their policies, their programs, really fly in the face of the majority interests of the black community. So that it's very difficult to locate a significant base that they have. On the other hand, I don't think that the black community was ever really monolithic in the sense of the fact that everybody believed everything 100%. There are certain conditions that made it necessary that black people think the same way about a lot of issues. One of them had to do with racism, the prevalence of racism that black people face in society, regardless of class, has given them a very similar attitude about racism and what to do about racism. So that to the extent that you continue to have it, you will continue to have a very strong unity of opinion about many things racial. With respect to economics, I think there you find probably the most divergence in the black community. What to do about economic policy, I think changes with one's personal circumstances. But I think there is, on most issues, what one could call a mainstream. And I think America really doesn't quite understand that these issues, which comprise the black mainstream, come out of the history of blacks, what they have experienced in America, and the striking similarity of how they're treated today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Walters. He's a professor of political science at Howard University, author of a book on black presidential politics in America, and he's advised members of the Congressional Black Caucus and was a consultant and a campaign manager for Jesse Jackson. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ron Walters, professor of political science at Howard and author of a book on black presidential politics in America. Do you think that racism is being manipulated in the primary campaigns? And let's start with the Democrats, and then we'll move to the Republicans.
Well, I certainly think racism is being manipulated because today there are so many ways to talk about race without actually discussing it.
Yeah, so you think there's code issues or code words being used now?
Yes, there are many sort of racially loaded, I call them race-valued terms that are being used, and they are part now of the public dialogue. Where the subtext, if we could call it that, really is a discussion about race or a dialogue about race. And there are issues such as crime. For example, we saw the very important role that the crime has played in the popular culture and in the imagination of many people, of course, that conjures up the black criminal and the role that blacks play in crime. The same thing about welfare, the same thing about such issues as teenage pregnancy or homelessness. To the extent that blacks are involved in these areas disproportionately, even though whites may be also involved in a larger sense. It makes no difference. They become identified with the black community, and therefore some of the measures that are being discussed about them are just horrendous. For example, there are legislators in the state of California and in the state of Kansas that have made proposals about welfare, which have to do with reducing the welfare caseload by sterilizing welfare recipients, free female welfare recipients, with some of the latest devices. Now, if in any other society, in any other time, if we had heard these proposals spoken out loud on the floor of a state legislature, we would have been appalled. But in this atmosphere, people can make such proposals. And I think subliminally on everybody's mind, there is a racial dynamic to it, which really is unspoken. And that is the insidious aspect of about it.
Do you think there's any particular candidate on the Democratic side who is doing the most to play on racial fears?
Well, I think that, again, I would say that Clinton's formulation of the welfare issue, which has to do with responsibility, quote-unquote, is, I think, the closest one could come to that kind of a syndrome that I'm discussing. To the extent, for example, that most of the people on welfare in the state of Arkansas are black. And we're talking about 60% of the people in his state are black. And then I think it obviously becomes sort of a racially charged issue to discuss welfare and coming out of his particular situation.
Let's look at the Republican Party. This is a party in which one of the people running in the primary is actually a former member of the Klan. How do you think David Duke has been using or avoiding the issue of race in his campaign?
Well, I think David Duke has become very sophisticated using these sort of code words that I've been discussing. The issue of welfare in a state like Louisiana, he has used very effectively when everybody knew, of course, he was talking about blacks. I think in the state of Louisiana, the welfare budget only constituted 2% of the general budget of the state. So you would think, of course, that this was a major, major problem. And it was, in fact, the problem that was keeping whites from being successful, if you listen to David Duke. But it really is a tiny part of the total expenditures of that state. And I would say the same thing about the national picture, that welfare is not the main problem in this country. And yet you have David Duke using that issue very successfully.
Let's look at President Bush during his last campaign. He used the Willie Horton story. That was interpreted by a lot of people as a not very coded way of playing on racial fears. Do you see anything like that emerging this time around?
Well, I think that they may not use the Willie Horton situation again because it drew so much public criticism. And so much post-fact and after-the-fact analysis by the press. But they may go on and use something else. And right now, I can't tell you what that is, but I'm sure that because of the power of racial symbolism and because it has proved to be a defining issue, I think that his handlers may find a way to use it once again.
The black vote is seen as an almost liability in some sectors. Some politicians are afraid to be seen as representing black interests. Do you think that fear comes out of a belief that there are a lot of racist white voters who will vote against blacks or against black issues? Or do you think that the issue is more an economic one than a racial one?
Well, I think it's the issue is really both cultural and political. I think in one sense it is cultural because many whites genuinely believe, that blacks have gone through a generation of racial preference, of which all of these preferences were accorded them, and they were accorded them at the expense of whites, and now is enough. Now, I think that what we ought to do really is to match up that particular sentiment with some reality. And to that extent, one of the tremendous and tragic things that has happened to us is that our friends in the Democratic Party and in the intellectual world did not really stand up to that sentiment. and to talk about, with any sense of accuracy or equity, this whole business of racial preferences. So that this has become ingrained in the mind of many people, and they have used that as a scapegoat for their own deleterious circumstances. And it is really pernicious. And let me just illustrate. I think it's pernicious because when you come to an issue like economic development, what will pull our economy out of the doldrums? There are many politicians now on the Democratic side who are arguing for middle-class tax cuts. When most of the, I would say, the reputable economists would say that spending for infrastructure would create jobs far more quickly. You have a distinguished economist like John Kenneth Galbraith, who has just put this forward in one of the congressional hearings. And one of the reasons why you probably won't get as much of an emphasis on spending for infrastructure is that people think that it will re-empower people in the urban sector. And you haven't heard any of these candidates, for example, talk about an urban policy. And yet, there is where you really could get this country moving again by spending on all sorts of the infrastructure that are necessary for people to make a very decent standard of living. So you won't get that discussion, you won't get that emphasis because of this trade-off now between the interest of the middle class, essentially the white middle class, and the interest of blacks in the minds of many people, and the fact that one policy has been associated with the Democratic Party traditionally.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Walters. He's a professor of political science at Howard University, author of a book about black presidential politics in America, and he's been a consultant to several members of the Congressional Black Caucus and a consultant to Jesse Jackson's campaigns as well. What is the state of debate now among black activists about whether there should be a third political party?
Well, I think that you have two candidates out there today. One is Lenore Fulani of the New Alliance Party, and the other is Ron Daniels of Project New Tomorrow. Both of them, of course, black independent candidates, and therefore heirs to a trend of thought in the black community that goes back a considerable period of time. But I think most recently back to 1980, when in fact in that year there was an attempt to form a national black party. In fact, it was called the National Black Independent Political Party. And that came about because of a strong dissatisfaction with the two-party system, with the fact that even then the two parties didn't seem to be as responsive. And quite frankly, with an attempt to try to make the electoral arena very dynamic. You have to realize that coming out of the civil rights movement, people were used to a very dynamic political theater. And elections, of course, are relatively slow, a mechanism for social change. And so the party idea was an attempt to try to invigorate it, to bring more blacks into it, more dynamism, add more leverage to the black vote. Now, some people think that this isn't a valid proposition. I tend to think that it does have at least a ring of theoretical possibility. If we look at the last election, the difference between the two candidates was not that great. 41 million for Michael Dukakis, 47 million for George Bush. The black vote itself, as I've already indicated, is far more than that. It could be 10 million. So the black vote alone could really make the difference between the two candidates. And therefore, that sets up the prospect of a leverage politics between the two parties.
So you think a black political party would ensure that Democrats and Republicans couldn't take the black vote for granted? Everybody would have to really work for it. It would become a significant force.
I think so. To the extent that it was going, that 10 million votes was going to be cast, I think that there would have to be then some competition for some part of that electorate. I don't think either side really could afford to forget about it because it's simply too large. And as I said, if you look at the difference between the two parties, it's not been all that great. And so it is a force to be reckoned with, and I think it would engender some serious competition. Add to that the fact that it wouldn't just be a black party. I think that, here again, historically, progressive whites have wanted to join in a coalition with some kind of independent force that was effective. The National Organization of Women indicated that they might form a political party. Labor hinted that they might form a political party. So if you do get a restructured Democratic Party in the form of this new coalition, it could turn out to be a very decisive force in American politics.
Are you for the development of a third party?
I see a dawning reality at this particular moment in American politics. And that is that there is such a shading going on between the Democratic and Republican Party that you might as well call both sides of the party Republicrats. And if particularly if you look at Clinton's campaign at the moment and ask yourself, what is the real difference between a Clinton, who is the theoretical winner, and a George Bush? There's very little room there. And so at issue for me is really the remaining character of the Democratic Party. What is that is a very important residual question to ask right now. And if you come to the conclusion that there is very little difference now, that the dynamics of the pressures out in the electorate are pushing both parties to a sameness, then that's an argument for perhaps not a third political party, but a genuine second political party. And it may happen because if the Democratic Party becomes, in fact, a carbon copy of the Republican Party, then I think naturally what you will begin to have is a reformulation of the party structure. There's some groups are going to be disaffected, will pull away, and try to seek their own interest in a different formulation. And so we may be at a very critical moment in the history of the two-party system, and it may be beyond just the question of race. It may be the disillusion of the Democratic Party as a party, which has a distinct characteristic.
Ron Walters is a professor of political science at Howard University and the author of Black Presidential Politics in America. He's consulted to members of the Congressional Black Caucus and Jesse Jackson. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.